The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third row seating, available dual wireless charging pads. You've got the H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on those dirt trails and kick up some mud. Or the third row seating gets your whole family in to experience the thrill together. The dual wireless charging pads make sure that no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead cell phone. Think about those adventurous activities you can do, like me, taking a ski trip up with the family, maybe going on a camping expedition, anything and everything. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
Are you looking for a new basketball shoe? If so, this is Gary Parrish here to tell you that the New Balance 2-Way V4 features the groundbreaking use of fuel cell technology with fresh foam, creating the ultimate combination of rebound and cushioning. Every step feels explosive and dynamic, and the upper construction features a lightweight textile that's supportive and breathable. So whether you're hitting the clutch shot or locking down the opposition, the 2-Way V4 gives you the tools to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the 2-Way at newbalance.com. There's Gary Parrish. Welcome back to the CBS Sports Eye on College Basketball Podcast, where we sometimes discuss camel fighting, dodo birds, and leaky black. Matt Norlander is here with me. If you're watching on YouTube, you know what to do to that like button. Shouts to Brandon Davies. And if you're watching on YouTube, you're not subscribed already, please go ahead and subscribe to the CBS Sports College Basketball YouTube channel while you're here. Let's get into it. It's a mailbag episode.
That's right.
It's a May mailbag. And I'm wearing my hat backwards in support of J.J. Redick.
Okay. Should I go get one too?
Yeah, I mean, podcasters.
Yeah, why not?
Us podcasters need to stay together.
That's right. I'm getting the hat right now. Hold on.
Get your hat backwards. Us podcasters, we need to stick together. Strengthen numbers with our hats on backwards.
You got a black action. I got a black backward hat action. Here we go.
We talked about this a little bit yesterday on the GP show. My producer there, Big Bet Bennett Doyle, he made a smart observation. He says the reason we are the first generation of old people wearing our hats backwards on podcast is because we're the first generation of old people doing podcasts. Secondly, we are. Tell me if this is right or wrong. Are we the first generation of people who wore our hat backwards?
Well, we're not in the same generation, you and I.
All right.
There is a line of delineation there. I can't speak to whether that's the case or not, but there might be something to that as well.
We didn't grow up with John Lennon and Mickey Mantle. We grew up with King Griffey Jr. and Fred Durst. So what do you want from us?
Oh man,
we were raised by King Griffey Jr. and Fred Durst. That's how we became all these usses. We were raised by a man who wore his hat backwards and did it all for the nookie.
I do not need to affiliate with Mr. Durst. I'll also say this: Dan Hurley been rocking the hat backwards ever since I known him. So, and he's of a similar generation, but maybe a little bit. He's closer.
He's just a few years older than me. Dan Hurley is, and he's a 2-time national champion. Sure. I think if a guy who's won 2 straight national championships can wear his hat backwards, J.J. Redick can as well.
That's correct. And so we'll do it in solidarity. So it's a mailbag episode, a mailbag, if you will, MAYLBAG. We got some questions to get to. We also. You can always hit the show at any point. Shouts to cbs@gmail.com. Because of that, we do get plenty of just random correspondence that aren't even questions. So before we launch into some of the cues for this episode, if you're watching live, you can toss a few questions there. And already off the bat, someone wants to know when they're getting podcast swag. Hey, I'm right there with you. I think we got to get. We've been working on a new logo for like 2 years. Once we get an actual new logo that's got some snap to it. Promise you, I have not forgotten about this. I want
they can change names of NFL franchises faster than they can get a new logo or any sort of podcast. Like, stop it. I haven't asked in years. I just assume Nothing ever is changing.
Okay.
Nothing.
I'm determined to make this happen before the end of the offseason. But famous last words. Okay, so we got some correspondence to hit you off the top, and then we'll get to the questions. First, we had a few people that hit us after last episode, and I know GP knows this, but if you're listening and we're wondering for an update, I have one for you. People let us know real quick. The most recent team to have multiple Final Four players was literally Arizona last season.
I was like, man, has this ever happened? He's like, yes. People in the Twitter, I was like, yeah, last year, idiot.
We got a few emails on that as well. Caleb Love from Carolina was at Arizona. So was Keyshaw Johnson, who was in San Diego State. They played in a Final Four. Tyler emailed Final Four weekend to remind us in the moment there that UConn and Purdue, playing for the national title, we're both in the top 12 of the week 6 AP poll. Remember that whole deal, GP? Although GP is now frozen on me. You gotta love a live show. Okay. All right. GP has frozen on me. There you go. You're back. Are you back?
I never knew I left. I was just sitting okay. Here.
You froze on me for a second there. All right. Tyler emailed to let us know that UConn and Purdue were in the week 12, top 12 of the week 6 AP poll. They played for a national championship. You, of course, remember this when we talked about this earlier in the season. Someone in the top 12 of the week 6 AP poll has gone on to win the title like every year for 2 decades. Remember that?
Of course I remember that.
Now, here's the thing. He goes, I would love for both of you to revisit your own rankings from that episode on December 13th. Well, here's the deal. I went back and found it.
I'm going to assume I had Purdue number one.
You did not. So trivia time. Who do you think was your 3-2-1?
On December what?
13th.
It would have been UConn, Purdue in some order, something like that.
Here's your top 8. We did 12. I'm not going to bog it down. 8 was Creighton. 7 for you was Tennessee. 6 was Marquette. 5 was UConn. Mm-hmm. And I gave you grief in the moment on that episode that you put in that low. 4 was Houston. 3 was Arizona. 2 mm-hmm. was Purdue. Mm-hmm. And 1 was Kansas. And I don't have the clip to play, but you said basically in the moment, you're like, tell me why that's stupid.
Well.
And it was. Well,
I didn't know Kevin McCullough was going to do whatever Kevin McCullough did.
It's hard to forecast the future. I had Creighton, Houston. Kansas was my number 6. You said that's the most disrespectful thing I've ever heard. Turned out to be fairly accurate. Baylor was 5, Marquette 4. I had UConn 3, Arizona 2. I had Purdue 1. I was Boilermaker before you. You had Purdue 2. I had Purdue 1. So that was a good little callback there. We'll bring it up again next season.
I hope the UConn fans get on your ass now. You were the one.
I had them higher than you. I had them third most likely to win the title at that point. You had them 5.
You were the one flying this Purdue flag back in December.
That's true. And you took it from me. How dare you? Another fella, Gavin, hit us up, and he said, so I'm driving through Nashville. Now to get the picture ready. I'm driving through Nashville on a vacation with my wife, and she says to me, whoa, that is one of the weirdest signs I've ever seen. You'll never believe what it says. And I ask her what it says, and she tells me, and what is it? What does that say, GP, for everyone listening? What does that sign say?
That says cock of the walk.
Cock of the walk.
What are they doing?
We are infiltrating our listeners' lives. GP had never heard the phrase cock of the walk as of 2 weeks ago on an episode. Lo and behold. He said, my wife has never listened to the podcast, so I couldn't believe she was telling me this since it just came up on the pod this week. And now you know it's a real thing.
You can get steak or chicken or shrimp and the world's best cut. Who knew the world's best cut?
The world's best catfish. All
right. About how big the world is, and the best catfish in the world is at cock of the walk. What a wild situation.
More and more people are finding the show on video, be it TV or YouTube. Michael sent in an email not too long ago, and he found out what you look like. It was a bit different from the theater of his mind. He said, I first started listening to the podcast. When I did, I pictured GP in my head as the only NCAA Gary face that I was familiar with. And what NCAA Gary? So we got a guy listening to this show for years. I don't know what he thought I look like, but in his head, you look like a different Gary. Nada, you want to bring up the Gary that I sent you? There we go. Gary Williams. Yes. I've been hosting a podcast with Gary Williams.
I don't understand because I'll get this sometimes, and people will be like, "Oh man, I just saw what GP looks like." Like, how is that even? Like, if you really listen to a podcast, like I listen to podcasts too, some, and I just Google what the person looks like because I want to have that in my head. I want to feel like I know. I want to feel like I can picture it. So I'm always befuddled by folks who randomly discover what I look like as if my face isn't just one Google away.
I still like this as a thing. This has been a thing for close to a decade. Listeners being shocked at what Gary Parrish looks like after hearing his voice.
I mean, in fairness, you know, some listeners are shocked. Like, I don't even know how to say this other than just say it directly. They think I'm black.
Yes, this has been a thing for 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get that all the time.
Yeah. I assure you he's not.
I mean, I look just like J.J. Redick. When I look in the mirror, what I see is J.J. Redick.
We get random emails, just streams of consciousness from listeners often. Like this one from a guy named Joseph. The entirety of the email which read, this is it. This is the only line in the email. Rodney Terry is Giancarlo Esposito.
I can see that.
Esposito, excuse me.
I can see that.
Gus Spring.
Yeah.
I agree, but it's just sent. Someone else wrote in, where can I buy my Longwoods t-shirt? Parrish is responsible for that. Mm-hmm. Graphic design is the passion of our listeners. Paul in Badgertown emailed in late February with one line and an attachment. It simply said, let's move the Final Four to Wisconsin. What do you say? I made this in Microsoft Excel. I want to say, like, why do we have this stuff? Again, you're going to have to watch to see. But then again, the email line in our podcast description, literally every episode says, email the show for any reason whatsoever. Shouts to cbs@gmail.com. And people take that to heart, Parrish. Mm-hmm. They email us anything and everything. Great. We got a lot of email photoshops in March and April. Grace Fox sent in this email when we talked about you and taking Jerry Palm's job and right. What would you look like if you had bangs? I think you've seen this, but just in case anyone missed it, this is actually the best of the bunch. It's either Jerry Parrish or Gary Palm. There were, by the way, there were many more, at least a half dozen more. This is the most flattering of them all, just so we're clear.
Worse ones. I mean, I look like if J.J. Redick became a bracketologist, that's what I look like there.
No hat on backwards in that one. Two more, and then we'll get to the questions there. This is from back in December. Earmuffs for the kiddos, by the way, on this one. Mac from Boston emailed in December. He said, I was listening. I couldn't help but bring this one up. I've been saving this one. Just because it's funny. I like the idea that our podcast is inadvertently causing chaos in the cars of families across this great nation and the world. I was listening to the mailbag episode. We did a Christmas mailbag episode, which I think this is the first one we've done since then. We'll mix in a few more this off season. I was listening to the mailbag episode while driving earlier this week. And this morning, when me, my wife, and my toddler hopped in the car, my phone connected to the car stereo. So I guess the Bluetooth, we all know that move, right? And started playing automatically where it left off. I kid you not, the very first thing you hear when the audio starts playing is GP saying the words, you look like a human penis.
Oh.
Thankfully, my little guy is still young enough where he doesn't have a clue, but my wife was like, what the hell are you listening to? I ended up spending the drive explaining how Gary is bald and how that comment referred to the mean things fans say to him when he writes stuff they don't like. Plus, you know, the whole show's vibe in general. You guys won her over, though, after I explained you're the ones who first turned me on to Guster. She became a fan. That's how far back this email is. He said, we just got tickets to go to the show in Boston next March. Hey, Mac, I was at that show. Let me know how you thought it was and what you thought. He ends with, the bad news for Gary, though, is the next time my wife listens to the show, she's probably going to hear his voice and go, is that the human penis guy?
Yeah, right. That's tough. That's tough. Tough one. It's tough one. But, you know, I accept responsibility.
That Bluetooth auto connect, it can get you.
Did you see Luka Doncic last night? Did you see that one?
Okay, so in just kind of waking up this morning, a little this, a little that, breakfast, I checked him real quick on the old social media, and I saw it. No, we're not playing the audio. No, we're not playing the video. But I said to myself, I bet you Parrish gets this into the show somehow, some way. Yes, I saw it.
You brought it up.
I did not.
You brought up Bluetooth.
Well, do we know for sure that was the thing?
It sounded like to, I mean, as somebody who knows what it sounds like, you know, it sounds like it. I would know that sound anywhere.
Okay.
It sounded like it.
If you are watching early here on a Friday morning and you don't know what we're referring to, just go. I'm not going to tell you what to type into your browser, but I think Luka Doncic press conference might get it done.
Yeah, I think just Luka Doncic will get it done.
Last one. This is kind of like a half comment, half question, and then GP, you can take it away. Jimmy Wynn tweeted at us. He said, y'all should do a hot takes episode this summer, mostly so someone can flesh out my hot take that NC State would have been justified moving on from Kevin Keats despite the Final Four run this year. And he said, yes, I know he has contractual extension benchmarks. So two things. One, that is a super, super hot take. And I do love it. I am open to the idea. Remind us, I guess, once we're really in the dog days there, of doing some sort of hot take episode, whether for the upcoming season or just general hot take stuff on basketball and otherwise. That sounds like it's actually got really good potential. And coming in heavy and hot, saying that NC State should have still fired Kevin Keats after pulling off maybe the most unlikely Final Four run in the history of the sport is about as hot as it gets. So I appreciate that input.
Just logically, I'm not speaking on Kevin or NC State situation at all, but just logically, I don't think that's crazy. I think it would be crazy to do it, but I don't. I think logically it makes sense. If you thought a coach was no longer doing a good job, you shouldn't get caught up in a 2-week great or 3-week in this case great situation. Logically, I understand.
Logically, yes, because realistically, and I reported this when I did a feature on NC State from the Final Four this year, like they were very much prepared and understood that Kevin Keats' job was on the line before they played Louisville in the ACC tournament. And they were down to Louisville at the half of that game. And then things all turned around. I did a whole thing on the events that led to them making a Final Four. But yes, 3 weeks before they made the Final Four, the idea that Kevin Keats was going to get fired was very much in the air. And even Kevin Keats, you know, admitted to me, like, you know, guys weren't stupid. They were aware of what might have been possible. But they made the Final Four. You got a contract extension. All is well. I do like the idea of a hot takes episode. We will take that into real consideration.
It appears I'm having real Wi-Fi problems here.
I think you might be having some, but I can hear you okay. I can hear you. That's all that matters.
I don't know. I actually don't think that's all that matters.
I'm just trying to. By the way, you're up for the first question here, Jack from Atlanta, just so we're clear and we're clear on that. And also, I thought that you paid like thousands of dollars to get government level, high quality Wi-Fi reliability in your house.
I do. And then something happened within the past week and I had them come back out and make everything better. And that lasted a few days, and now we appear to be right back where we are. Plus, I have 50,000 kids streaming stuff nonstop in this house. Okay. So, like, it's a
50,000.
Yeah, life is full of challenges.
Norlander. All right, well, let's roll with the punches, man. You're up first.
All right, first question comes from Jack. He's in Atlanta. I know one thing. I don't want to see Drake going down there.
All right, let's go. By the way, on that note, let's get it going here. I'm not kidding. The BBL Drizzy beat that Metro made has been in my head for a week. Like, legitimately one of the catchiest things I've heard all year. But yes.
No, not like us is the catchiest thing you've heard all year. I don't want to see Drake down in Atlanta acting like a rapper. OV Ho. This comes from Jack. He's down in Atlanta.
Yes.
Quavo said it was cool. With a few years of perspective now available on the new transfer years, I was wondering about how you viewed its impact on competitive parity. We know that you largely approve of it from a moral ethical standpoint. If coaches can leave, players should be able to as well. But one concern I heard a couple of years back was that all of the good players from lesser schools would just jump ship to the more prestigious powerhouse programs. Do you think the competitive balance between the haves and have-nots is better, worse, or equivalent to what was before the new shape? Go ahead.
So I still think we're working with a small sample size. I would say competitive balance is also being impacted by things beyond just the transfer portal and NIL, but that's the biggest factor for sure. I also think things like scheduling, which hasn't improved for the most part across the sport and will now be worsened, will continue to get worsened for mid-majors due to conference expansion, bloat, you know, TV mandates across the board with all that stuff. I think that impacts competitive equity. Not that there ever was any. Let's not, you know, work under false pretenses here. But I will also say that transfers do go both ways. You know, guys do transfer up from mid-majors to the high major ranks. And they're all, it also goes the other way. In fact, what we mentioned on a previous show, GP, was how there are teams that are basically looking to top out 11 scholarship players at the high major level. I don't think you're going to see that as prominently as commonplace at the mid-major level. And what that's going to mean is the guy who would be 12 and 13 on a given roster, that might be the second, third, or fourth best player on a mid-major team. And so it does kind of go both ways. I don't know how you define the phrase competitive balance. Is it how frequently teams are making the NCAA tournament as an at-large win rate in the tournament? It's kind of a broad thing, but I get the sensibility of the question. I would say this. I think it's slightly worsened, but we're still early in this, and I think it's never been harder to be a coach at a mid-major program than it is right now.
I agree, I guess, that it's slightly worse, but it's like, I don't care. Like, I don't care, and because competitive balance between the so-called haves and have-nots has never really been a thing anyway. Like, Kentucky always is going to have players like Rob Dillingham and Reed Shepard, and Oakland is always going to have players like Jack Golke. That's the way it's always been. That's the way it's always going to be. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it's never – I've never understood the idea of, like, competitive balance between – high majors and mid majors, because it's just never existed. So people are always worried about it, but it's like worrying about unicorns. Like, they're not real, I don't think. And, you know, my understanding is that unicorns aren't real. So, I just don't, competitive balance is not a real thing. Beyond that, Jack notes this. I also celebrate it. It doesn't, I don't roll my eyes at it. I celebrate it. I think it's awesome. There's a young man who is, I believe, from North Carolina, and the remind me his name, from Belmont, going to North Carolina.
Okay, Tyson.
He's from North Carolina.
Yeah.
He probably dreamed of going to North Carolina, you know, and playing in the ACC. That's probably always his dream. And then he just couldn't do that out of high school because, he wasn't heralded in that way. But now he's going to get that opportunity. I look at that as an amazing story. I don't look at that as something bad for college athletics. So just like I celebrate when a mid-major coach does so well at the mid-major level, he can go be a high-major coach. I do the same thing with players, and I care nothing at all about competitive balance.
All right, next question. I'm going to try and keep this breezy. Elijah in Las Vegas asked, do you believe we'll ever get to a point where college basketball programs have a GM or someone on staff, not a coach, dedicated to only recruiting, roster retention, transfer portal, NIL, et cetera, either add a staffer or replace one assistant coach with that quote-unquote GM position? As much as coaches dread the increasing demands of the job, are they still too controlling to let that happen? This is something of an obvious question, but I did want to include this one, GP, and take it away here because I think there are certain things in the sport that fans might not realize are a thing, but are, and this is one of them.
There are GMs or de facto GMs, yes, in college athletics already. I don't think it'll ever be, maybe I shouldn't say ever be, but I'd be surprised if it ever gets to a point where it is set up like NFL franchises and NBA franchises. In other words, like the general manager is like, you know, in a typical NBA franchise, a coach, not all, but most, a coach has very little say in personnel, very little say in who you're drafting, very little say in who you're going to get in free agency. Like, you might have a voice in the room, but it ain't up to you. I don't think a college coach is going to hand over that type of responsibility to a so-called general manager. Like, I can't imagine Dan Hurley ever getting to a point where he says, hey, you go out and just get the play,
right. Yeah.
Figure it out, and then I'll coach them when you get them to me. That I don't think that happens, but I do think there is going to be somebody on most high major staffs very soon, if they're not already, who is in charge of like understanding what's available, what might be available, and working hand in hand, doing a lot of the legwork on the front end before the head coach even gets to the point where they got to sit down with somebody.
Yes, this is increasing by the year. My broad survey of this, and like at the power conference level, I'd say 20 to 25% of programs that are high majors have someone doing this. I mean, if you go and check actual team pages, like Kyle Church, he left FAU with Dusty May. He is now identified on the Michigan team page as the general manager of the Wolverines. You've got Laval Jordan do the same thing. He is now a former Butler coach. He was at Fox recently. He's now the GM of DePaul men's basketball. Mark Fox is doing it at Kentucky. Baker Dunleavy a year ago left coaching Quinnipiac here in Connecticut. He is now the GM of Villanova. So you've got that a lot more. You also have something similar called the director of recruiting. Notre Dame has that with Brian Snow. He used to do work, obviously, in the recruiting space and did a really good job with it with 247. And his job, and much like the other guys I mentioned, is to have an awareness of the portal and who might be likely to go in the portal eventually, but also to truly have a balance sheet of, okay, when it comes to guys that are going to get into this thing and they're on the transfer market, how much are they going to go for in the NIL space? How much do we actually have? And keeping a balance sheet out there, this role is only going to become more commonplace, but GP's dead on. It's never going to be, from a hierarchy standpoint, going to be like how they do it in the NBA and in the NFL. But head coaches don't want to be burdened by this in terms of tracking a lot of this stuff, because it is a ton. And so, yeah, it's a good question, but it is out there, has become a thing in the past couple of years. And if we're going to continue to be in this space moving forward, which it certainly feels like we are, then I would expect this kind of role to be almost universal, at least at the high major level, in the next 2 to 3 years.
Don from New York City asks, is there a newish coach that has had a rough start and or not lived up to expectations, but has the IQ, tools, skills to eventually turn it around into a Hall of Fame career like Mike Krzyzewski? You got a name?
I've got a couple names on this, but before I give you my names, I feel like, should we do a classic before the commercial break tease? Can I get a word from our partners?
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
What's up, Anderson Shot. Cooper?
No, what's up, Knuckles?
I know.
You're not watching the show. You have no idea what we're talking about. So is there a newish coach that's had a rough start or not lived up to expectations, but can eventually make the Hall of Fame because he's just made of that stuff? Coach K is the listen, that's super lofty. So I get the spirit of the question, but Krzyzewski in years 1 through 3 at Duke, he obviously had 5 years in Army before that. He went 38-47. You're almost definitely not making it to year 4, not definitely, but almost not making it to year 4 if you're at a high major and your first 3 seasons you're about 10 games under 500 and don't make the tournament. So there's definitely no A to A comparison here. There are two guys that are going there that kind of sort of had this. Scott Drew, but the job wasn't expected to be good. But he, from a record standpoint, they weren't good early at Baylor. And now you look what he's done. He's going to make the Hall of Fame. And then Dan Hurley is going to go to the Hall of Fame. But if you look at his, he had made the tournament at Rhode Island, so it's not the same thing. But at UConn specifically, it was good. It wasn't amazing. And then all of a sudden, he's made back-to-back tournament runs and won it all 2 years in a row. I think Drew or Hurley have the best chance of being at a near K level eventually after having, not killing it out of the gate. My two names, because it's hard. This is a hard question. It's you got to pick someone who hasn't been good, but you think has the stuff to eventually we'll look up in 10, 15 years and be that guy's one of the 5 best coaches in the game. The two that I would bring up that I think have a chance that haven't been, absolute gangbusters is, I think, Micah Shrewsbury, who did take Penn State to the tournament. So even then he's done something notable, but it hasn't been, crazy. I think Micah Shrewsbury has a real chance to grow into an elite level college basketball coach. And then Dennis Gates at Missouri is coming off a brutal, terrible year. But if you told me that Dennis Gates wound up becoming, you know, a top 10 coach in the sport by, you know, 2030, 2032, like that's not unthinkable to me. But this is a very hard one because you're trying to pick coaches that have not accomplished a ton that you think will eventually be sitting at the big boy table. So that's my answer.
Dennis Gates did pop into my head. I think, and we're nitpicking here, but the truth with him is his career actually got off to a great start.
It's not even an easy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then he had this bad year. So yes. We'll see where it goes. I thought of Scott Drew. It obviously doesn't fit perfectly because he's not a newish coach, but his head coaching career did get off to a rough start. There's another one. Dusty May was 23-25 in CUSA in his first 3 years at FAU.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's such a hard job, and he took over.
Such a hard job. He was 23. First of all, the fact that you're coming for Dusty May again.
No. I was just actually trying to think of somebody who has a chance to be great. And I think Dusty's got a real opportunity to be great at Michigan. And he did start 23-25 in CUSA.
He gave us a shout. Nada, do you have that, by the way? He gave us a shout earlier. I think he had media availability earlier this week. And he referenced something that I guess we talked about on a recent show. You brought it up, GP, where if you had seven or more transfers come into your roster, it wasn't, you weren't setting yourself up to be successful. Obviously, he's a different situation altogether there. There he is. Nada has it. May said, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I obviously haven't had as much time the last couple of weeks. The magic number, I think, has been seven. If you have seven or fewer portal guys, I'll give a shout out to the CBS guys. I think it's Parrish and Norlander that said, if you have seven or less transfer portalers, that equates to success. So we appreciate that. I don't think that's our research,
that was something I saw on social media from somebody I still to this moment don't remember who did it.
Passing along with that attribute.
We're just passing information around, and now it's made it all the way to Ann Arbor. Okay.
Okay.
No, but I just thought that was not Dusty, to be clear about that. That was not considered a shot. It was considered, who do I think can be great? I think Dusty can be great at Michigan. And he did start two games below 500 in his league in his first 3 years at FAU. Then obviously Final Four time, maybe it's Final Four time.
It's true. He's got a shot there.
Yeah. Hey, another one. Tell me if this fits. Bryce Drew.
Yeah. You know what?
Got fired at Vanderbilt, and he's going to, if he wants it, have an opportunity to get the next high major. He's going to get another high major job if he wants it. And if he kills it there, I wouldn't be shocked if we looked up in 5 years and we go, Bryce Drew is one of the 10 to 15 best coaches in America, and Vanderbilt fired him once upon a time.
Yeah, I did. I think it was last week. I do the thing where I actually wait 4 years to grade all the coaching hires in a given cycle. And 2020 was super weird because I usually just do the high majors. But 2020, the only high major was Steve Forbes. So then I said, OK, well, since there was only one high major, I want to, you know, not just, you know, I'm not going to let a 6 minute read go to waste. No shot. I could have filed 430 words. You think I was going to do that? There's no chance. So I looked at the most successful mid-major hirings of 2020, and Bryce Drew, it's probably been the best one of them all. I mean, he has been, I'm going to drop two gangbusters on one episode. He's been gangbusters at Grand Canyon, has been out to the point where, as I was doing it, I was like, and he was involved in a couple other jobs and turned him down. But I was like, man, he is still there. Like, he could easily right now be at a high major after how great he has been. And he has been great at Grand Canyon. That's a good call, GP. I think he's got a real shot. Next question. We got a lot of transfer stuff, this is the only other one transfer one in here, but I want to at least represent the volume of transfer questions that we got in there. Scott from God knows where. Always send where you're from when you do it, if you can. Scott from God knows where, who is absolutely obsessed with the show. We always appreciate our listeners who are obsessed. Says, since the unlimited transfers are here to stay, how long before, this is an interesting question, by the way, that's which I wanted to include it, of course. How long before a power program and a mid-major program in their collectives step up to help each other out? For example, I'll use Indiana and Indiana State. Scott, by the way, I appreciate you invoking Indiana in this. I'm sure GP does as well. So he says, let's say that Indiana has interest in a few high school prospects, but simply does not have the scholarships to use. They tell the kids to go to Indiana State, develop their game, and a year or two down the road, they can transfer up. On the contrary, Indiana eventually would have three players transfer out that aren't part of the future plans. What if they had a landing spot for them with the Sycamores. So the players don't care because they'll get more playing time, and they could still be getting, if the collectives collaborated, money for that. Would love to get your thoughts. Relatedly, John in South Carolina asked, with this being the last year that players are receiving an additional COVID year of eligibility, do you believe we'll begin to see noticeable change in the number of players that actually go into the portal or the quality therein? So yeah, GP, you ever see some outright collusion between a high major and a mid major? I'm going to say no, but it is a fascinating concept. And I wrote about this a couple of years ago when I had a couple coaches speak on background over the fact that they were recruiting players not to get them as soon as possible out of high school, but to be on their radars. You've actually seen this. You really are paying attention around college basketball. You see this pop up every so often where they don't want them on the first take. They want them when they hop in the portal 1, 2, 3 years after they've started college there. This is just extending that out to quite the conspiratorial level. What are your thoughts?
I don't know that that's happening, like actually happening. I can tell you I have had at least one coach tell me he wants to do this. High major coach, he said I should... The way it was explained to me, one of his close friends is a mid-major coach. And he said, I've talked to him and it's like, let's just like you be my AAA program and I'll be your big league program. And when I get three guys that are at the end of my bench and they need to transfer down, I'll send them to you and then send me your three best players. You know, like it's just, I'll call your guys up. I'll send you some guys down and we can make it work like that. So the idea is out there. Coaches are thinking about this type of stuff, but I don't know that anybody actually has like an agreement in place.
This would be tampering to the extreme. I love it.
I will say, here's some free advice to any parents who are of like a top 150 guy or a top one borderline top 100 guy. You know what I would do if I'd let my son make his own decision. But if I were involved in the decision-making process, the smartest thing you can do right now is not be ranked 117th and go to Baylor.
Right.
You know what you do? Go to a mid-major or a low major and ball out and then pop right in the transfer portal and say, I need $700,000, Baylor. You go to Baylor out of high school, ranked 110th in the country, that price is one price. You go to a mid-major, ball out, first conference, now you just make $500,000 doing that. That to me, that's the smart move now. Go play and then jump in the portal and just.
Yeah, that's you got to get the work done. You got to be productive, but that is intriguing. And certainly it would be hard, I think, for a player who's borderline 3-star to 4-star, that'd be your 3-star if you're in that range to maybe do that. But there are real benefits down the road, and that would be a wise move. You look at the number of guys who have gone into the portal this year and last year cycle who are coming from mid majors, and I mean, I'll just tell you, like there are players right now even in the portal that are commanding like very high prices, 750 plus. I'm talking from mid majors, 800,000 plus. Just one specifically, Chaz Lanier, who is going through the draft process, and Kentucky is heavily recruiting him. Tennessee is heavily recruiting him. BYU is still in there, but I think that I think BYU will be priced out because the understanding right now is that Chaz Lanier has become such a hot commodity that his NIL price will be in the neighborhood of $1 million. And this is someone from North Florida who most college basketball fans have no idea about, who Tennessee and Kentucky fans had no idea about up until 2 or 3 weeks ago. And he was a really, really good player for 4 years at North Florida. Wasn't ranked 110th coming out of high school, but you see how much value is increased there overall with these players. It's an intriguing proposition, GP. As to the other question real quick, the number of players, it's going to drop because we're losing the bonus COVID year. This was the last year that players with an additional year of eligibility are in the portal. If you remove walk-ons, here are the numbers. This year we had 1,775 all scholarship players that were in the portal. Last year was 1,528. The year before that it was 1,495. And the year before that it was 1,545. Those are players that are scholarship. If you add walk-ons, you get another couple hundred in there. So that number I probably would expect to drop down to, I don't know, 1,200 or so moving forward, maybe 1,100. And So the number will go down. I do think this is the apex year of chaos in terms of NIL, number of players, bonus COVID year, everything, like everything at once. I think this is the worst it's ever been and the worst it will be in terms of uncertainties and unknowns. But the quality of player is not going to drop. There's still going to be really, really good players in the portal. There just won't be as many of them. And I think the squeeze will be on for coaches to not be able to rely on the portal and get really good players out of high school again at no matter what level you are, because you just aren't going to have as many options moving forward starting next year.
Jesse from Spokane asked the following. Gonzaga made his 24th straight NCAA tournament appearance, a few, and tied his 24th cut. Both came close to having their streaks in this year. Who is more likely to have their streak in first? For me, that's obvious. It's Tiger, right?
I think so. Really good question. your Wi-Fi was a little bit glitchy there. So just in case, I'll quickly say it again. Gonzaga just made his 24th straight tournament. Tiger Woods just made his 24th straight Masters cut. This is a great question. Tiger Woods will be 49 next year when he plays in the Masters. Presumably, he'll play in the Masters through the end of the decade, hopefully, if his health holds up. Mark Few is 61. And could have anywhere from 2 to 6 years left, I'd say, coaching the Bulldogs there. It is possible that the final season of Mark Few's career corresponds, you know, 1-2 weeks later with the last time Tiger Woods plays in the Masters. Like, that's possible. I don't know if it'll happen, but it's possible. This year, Tiger Woods made the cut without much of a sweat. He had a 72 in the second round. He was tied for 25th when he made the cut. He actually wound up finishing 60th at 16. He was the last place finisher among all players that made the cut at the Masters this year. But I would say Tiger's streak is more likely to snap sooner than Gonzaga not making the tournament. But this is the outside the box kind of question that I love for these mailbag episodes. It really did make me think, because it's really hard. I mean, we tell Gonzaga fans and Kansas fans, like Michigan State fans, you know, don't take it for granted, because no one else does this. Like, you're supposed to have at least one down and bad year. We thought it would be Gonzaga, maybe, you know, back in early February. Look up, GP. They make another Sweet 16. They had what, a 5 seed. They got in with ease yet again. So I will agree with you, and I'll go Tiger.
Yeah, it's just, you know, Mark.
Oh boy, my guy's Wi-Fi is really tripping up here, GP. I might go personal hotspot. Garrett from Parts Unknown asks, who do you think has a chance to be a Danny Sprinkle next year? And by that, he means get a bigger job this year, or get a job this year, and then the following year, springboard it 1 year right away. Danny Sprinkle went to Utah State, and now he's the coach at Washington. There are a few decent candidates. Looks like your Wi-Fi is back to being reliable. But you go first. Who's most likely to be the Danny Sprinkle coaching at a high major team in 2025 after getting a job this year at a mid-major level?
Josh Lewis.
Yeah. I think Josh Schertz at St. Louis is a very likely candidate there. I would say Schertz. I thought you might go this one. What about Chris Mack at Charleston?
I could say that name popped into my head. It just seems like, I don't know, how good are they going to be in year one? And do you really want to leave Charleston? It's a great place to live.
I know. It is a great spot. It's one of the best mid-major jobs in the country. I think Schertz is one. I think Mack is two. And then I think Ben McCollum at Drake, who has won, what, 4 national titles at the D2 level. Really, really good reputation as a coach. I think he's your other guy. Good question. I will put it above 50% that someone that got hired at a mid-major this year will be at a high major in 2025.
Okay, where are we at now? And we probably need to skip some if we're being honest.
We can keep going. Next one's a quick one. Christopher with a K.
Are there any rumblings that the new Baylor Arena is going to fix the camera situation?
All right, I have a quick answer on this. Does the camera position at Baylor's new arena bother you?
No. I recognize it as different, but it doesn't bother me. Like, my kids leaving stuff laying all over the house bothers me.
This became a, and 50,000 people using the Wi-Fi, by the way. I get the feeling that that kind of bothers you as well.
Yes. My Wi-Fi situation bothers me too.
Yeah, this became a major thing. Baylor got this brand new spanking arena. Looks awesome. Looks amazing. And you're up there in the bird's nest. It sounds like they are seriously considering changing this starting into next season. I don't think a decision has been made all the way, but people there are very aware that it has become a thing. Appreciate the question. And I would say that it will get changed moving into next year. Kriston from the Canadian Armed Forces in a small town just outside Ottawa telegrams us. I've been listening for 8 years, but this is the first time I'm ever reaching out. You often speak of the best jobs in college basketball. In particular, you have referred to Ohio State as a top 20 coaching job in the sport. What constitutes the best jobs? I know the big brands like Kentucky, Carolina, Duke, et cetera, are some of the best available. But what makes like Ohio State or Arkansas a top 20 job? Or subsequently, what makes DePaul one of the worst gigs in the major conferences? I've got thoughts on that. Paris has thoughts on that. But first, Nada, how about one more word from our partners?
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. Win. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Baseball has begun, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today in 5, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Sanfel, every Monday through Saturday as we deliver all of your fantasy baseball needs in just 5 minutes. We'll break down the biggest performers, news, and prospects who could make an impact this season. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.
All right. What to you makes a job top 20 job, GP?
I think it changes with the changing landscape of the sport. But right now, what's your collective look like? What kind of NIL resources do you have? Facilities, history, booster support, that kind of stuff. Like institutionally, are you set up to succeed? And at a place like Ohio State, you are. Evidence being that Jake Diebler has already put together a top 20 roster within, you know, a little more than a month of the season ending. So to me, it's those types of things. It's again, we didn't used to talk collectives and NIL stuff. This is all relatively new, but right now that's probably the biggest component of it. Like how much money do you have available to you to team you're trying?
Yep. Resources. NIL is the biggest factor now. It just has become that. That is the major thing. Since we last podcasted, I had a story go up with Dennis Dodd earlier this week about this tournament that's going to go down in Las Vegas later this year, 8-team tournament. You've got, let's see if I can, Alabama, Houston, San Diego State, Rutgers, Texas A&M, Oregon, and I'm missing one more in there that I can't remember off the top of my head. They're going to play in it. And as one of the coaches at those schools told me, you know, every decision we do right now is based on NIL, every single one. If you didn't see the story, we'll drop it in the pod description there. We're waiting on an 8th team to join that, by the way, but each team that's going is going to get paid $1 million. And this is going, and they want to make it 16. They have every intention, the organizers, at making it 16 teams next year. People are wondering if it will possibly make any money when you put that much money into it, but whatever, we'll see if it does or it doesn't. The point is you have something like that that's out there. You're probably going to try and invite copycat events and coaches and schools are going to chase after it because NIL is the most important factor with this. And related to that, I think the Big Ten and the SEC will probably shift a few of these moving forward in the years to come because of their media rights deals, because they are so far out ahead because of football with everyone else. But other things are like program prestige, history, fan support, geography, a lot of factors, but it is NIL. And just specifically to the DePaul question, you know, there has been a culture of mediocrity that has seeped into the walls and halls of that place. The arena isn't close to campus. It hasn't been good forever. And so it's at the high major level, but they just never win. And so with that, it just becomes an unappealing job prospect. But that came from a dedicated listener in Canada. And sometimes we get hoops questions from college hoops fans that might not have grown up on it. And so I appreciate everyone that takes the time to send in a note there and might not be aware of some of the particulars. But yes, Ohio State being in the Big Ten with all of its resources, I think is objectively a top 20 job in the sport. And then Arkansas with the resources, it has a bigger NIL war chest than anyone this offseason. That's the running understanding among coaches in the sport. And in addition to the history and the fan base, like insane fan support, really good home arena, I think Arkansas is fairly considered a top 20 job in the sport. Next question is yours, GP. And don't worry, this is a quick answer. I've got it taken care of real quick.
There have been several games this year in which there was an end of game play where a player can clearly be seen stepping out of bounds with the ball in their hand in front of the referee, but then out of bounds was not called, and the game out of bounds play. The ball out of bounds play not reviewed. Blah, blah, blah. I don't know why. It's stupid. If we can go back and look at if somebody's foot is on the three-point line and make a decision off of that, I don't know why we don't go back and look if somebody's foot is on a baseline or out of bounds on the side of the court. I don't understand why we don't do that.
I told you this would be quick. The rule will be in change next season, pending final approval in the next few weeks. This is a direct release recently. So if you missed it, this is going to change. Not being able to review if a player's foot, hand, whatever is out of bounds before a made shot, it was among many stupid non-rules. Finally, because we had those instances in that reader's question where he was talking about TCU Georgetown, St. Mary's Gonzaga, the NCAA Men's Basketball Rules Committee has proposed expanding video replay to include whether a player's foot last touching the court was in bounds on a made shot before time expired. Since these plays are automatically reviewed to see whether the shot was released before time expired, committee members hope to give officials another tool to get the call right. If the player's foot is determined to be out of bounds, officials would put the exact time of the violation on the game clock. Jeff O'Malley, who is the secretary rules editor for men's basketball, said the review does not add additional stoppage time as the officials will already be at the monitor review. Furthermore, the changes would align with NBA and FIBA. So if you were unaware, that very stupid rule will be changed starting next season. My question, Aaron from New York City hit us with this one. Hey guys, my name is Aaron Andrews, but it's actually A-R-E-N. So Aaron Andrews, I'm a 16-year-old dude from New York City. In case we thought the Aaron Andrews everyone knows was emailing us, Aaron Andrews, the 16-year-old dude from New York City, is clarifying that. We appreciate that, Aaron. He said, I'm a huge college basketball geek. I listen to about 10 different college basketball podcasts. Yours is by far my favorite. I haven't missed an episode. I was scrolling on Instagram and saw someone saying that they thought the current Montverd team could beat a bad D1 team like Siena or Manhattan. Do you guys think this is true? GP, I asked three people in basketball this question, but before I give their answers, I want yours. And here was the current Montverd team, starting five, I guess. Cooper Flagg, best prospect in the country. Liam McNeely going to UConn, he was 10th. Derek Queen going to Maryland was 12th. Asa Newell is 18th. He's going to Georgia. Those are all five-star prospects. And then they've got Robin Wright, 21st. Going to Baylor. Curtis Givens, a three-star, he's going to LSU. So could that team beat a bad D1 team? The way I framed it to coaches was the 350th team at KenPom last season, which just happened to be Loyola Maryland. What do you say? Well, Parrish's Wi-Fi has...
I know the question because I'm looking at it, but I couldn't hear much of what you said. Simply put, yes, I think the high school team filled with five stars could beat a low major college basketball team. In fact, we see that all the time. They're called Kentucky bye games.
Okay, so here's what I got. This is a great question because it's not like UConn against the Pistons, who were 14-68, you know, that's not going to be close. We've talked about that. That's never going to be a question there. I asked an SEC assistant who has played sub 320 KenPom teams, and he gave me a score. He said Montverde 76, Loyola Maryland 64, in part because he's seen his team play poorly against bottom 30 competition and win games by 20. An NBA scout I talked to said he would take Montverde. He said, I understand the different qualities of a typical D1 player and the maturation experience they're equipped with, but this is still a point in time where a unique talent like Cooper Flagg and the athleticism of Asa Newell and the ball skills of Derek Queen to go along with a coach, Kevin Boyle coaches Montverde, that would equate to a team that is talented enough and already hits the ledger of physicality. I appreciate the thoughtfulness of the scout. And competitiveness, has the size and athleticism to overcome what those 3 to 5 years of college basketball might have done. He says it would be close, but he would take Montverde. And then I asked an assistant in the Big East. The assistant said 0% chance that Montverde wins. 0%.
Well, he that's said, dumb. You can tell that assistant he doesn't know what he's talking about.
He said 0%. He said
0% against, chance.
I know. That, he said playing 22-year-olds, even with a terrible team, against high school players that have never faced college competition. He said 0%. So I got two that Montverde and one. Both sides of the aisle, but he said 0% chance.
That's wrong. I mean, we watch this kind of thing all the time. You take the number one recruiting class in America, put them at Kentucky, put them at Duke, and then they play low major schools, and they beat the shit out of them all the time. Like, this happens all the time.
I gotcha. I guess this is exclusively a high school team, so, like, the guy 6'7", 8" off the bench is not going to start at Kentucky, going to play at Kentucky, so I think that's where the thought might have come in. But yeah, no, I thought that was intriguing. We only got three more to go, GP.
Oh, that. What would, this is from Courtney in Dayton. What would it take for a high mid-major program to make the jump to a power conference? I mean, this is another thing that happens all the time. It would, you know, it takes all the things that it, you know, great football. You know, in SMU's case, just rich people. Any number of things.
Oh, yeah.
And football and market sizes and stuff like that. I do think we kind of settled in now. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not convinced that we won't have more movement. You know, the Big Ten and SEC further expand than the ACC and the Big 12 or whatever have to go and find new schools to fill those holes. Like that'll happen. But it's in terms of what does it take? It's pretty similar to what it's always taken.
Well, no, but your connection is good here, so I want to keep it while I got you. But I included this in particular because she's a fan of Dayton, and she brings up Memphis. Like, it just inform the audience. Like, why hasn't Memphis gotten to a bigger, better league despite its location, its history, and its commitment to both football and basketball?
I think it's a mistake. Somebody should have invested in Memphis because of the FedEx connection, because of how deeply Memphis matters in Memphis. Like, Houston doesn't matter in Houston the way Memphis matters in Memphis. And like, St. Louis doesn't matter in St. Louis as much as Memphis matters in Memphis. I think that's something outsiders don't really understand properly. But to answer the question directly, the football stadium is bad. The school is not like the university presidents are turned off by Memphis's academic reputation. I say this as a graduate of the school, but it's better than it's ever been, but it's not, you know, one of the great institutions in America. I have heard some administrators tell me, you know, that it's, you know, the statistics just sort of bear this out. It's a dangerous city, and the football stadium is in a dangerous part of town, or at least on the edge of a dangerous part of town. All of these things are factors. All of these things play into it.
Yeah. Courtney was asking, like, aside from landing top recruits and winning, which is becoming harder for mid-majors to do, like, what's a mid-major to do to get itself in a position to get an invite to a power conference? She's asking because she's a fan of Dayton. We appreciate it. She also says she's one of us.
Well, for Dayton, it would probably have to be like a Big East thing, right?
Correct. And I think she's wondering with that, because it was a very well-thought-out email, Courtney. We appreciate you so much. And she actually has provided, like, attendance data. Like, Dayton is just so hardcore. And she said, like, I'm biased toward him, but even Memphis, San Diego State, Gonzaga, what do they need to do to make the jump? Speak to this really specifically here, because she was wondering, like, is it the facilities? Is it rabid fan base? Is it historically strong program? Geographic fit? Fans that travel well? There's a lot of the stuff that goes into it, but it's about how much money you provide to a conference. If you have football, and in absence of football, obviously Dayton would be Big East, but like, you've got Xavier there. Like, Xavier has no interest in having Dayton join the conference, right? And has effectively blocked the idea of that ever happening since Xavier got into the Big East, because it's obviously a natural competitive geographic rival that, frankly, Dayton versus Xavier, those, even though Cincinnati and Xavier are rivals, like, those two are on fairly, I want to be clear about this, Xavier fans, don't lose your minds here, fairly even footing. If you put Dayton in the Big East with Xavier, it's easily conceivable how Dayton could be stride for stride with Xavier in that. So Xavier has no interest in that. So they are effectively blocking it, because the president of Xavier is obviously buddy-buddy with the presidents around the Big East, and they don't want to allow for that to happen. There's not enough of an upside for the Big East to do that. So you have something that is blocking it there. But I will say this on Dayton, and then I've got a quick one on Gonzaga, and then we can wrap up with the final two, GP. There is something to be said about getting great in your neighborhood, being great and dominating there. Gonzaga is the ultimate outlier with that, obviously. I mean, Gonzaga, you know, go back 6 months ago and there was real anticipation and curiosity about Gonzaga going to the Big 12. Well, guess what? Like the Big 12 had its, you know, spring meetings last week, and Gonzaga didn't even come up on the agenda there. It's like, that's not to say that it will never happen, but there is no momentum and has not been momentum around that prospect for months and months now because it doesn't have football. And a lot of athletic directors in that conference aren't eager to do that. Brett Yormark desperately wants Gonzaga to be in the Big 12. He would make it happen tomorrow if he had the actual power to, but he doesn't have the power yet because Gonzaga is not providing enough, particularly as we're like shifting with media landscapes and rights deals. There's a lot that kind of goes into that, but Gonzaga has benefited from knowing its territory and dominating. San Diego State would have been in the Pac-12 if the Pac-12 didn't disintegrate. So each situation is a little bit different. It's a really good question. I understand it, but to Parrish's point, I agree. We seemingly have settled here. It's never, ever done. Realignment is always on the move, but we're getting closer. And I understand why it can be frustrating for Memphis fans because Memphis feels out of place. Like Memphis feels like it's in a league, just a level below what it should be. And Dayton can obviously has the potential to outperform what it is in the A-10. And Gonzaga has been so good. Is it a certain special, unique situation, or would it be better off in the Big 12? I actually think there's pros and cons on both that, but it's a good question. Basically comes down to how much you're worth and if a TV network or a TV contract is going to want.
That right there is the main problem for Dayton. You can have the best basketball program and the best fan base, but then you got to call Fox and ESPN and say, if we add Dayton, how much more money are you giving us? And when they answer that question,
yes,
adding Dayton is no longer an option for you.
Correct. That's a major factor. Just, you know, one other example is like the Big East is going to have a new deal get done later this year with multiple networks, but Fox is expected to have the primary rights deal. And previously, before UConn was in, that deal was worth close to $40 million annually for the entire conference. And now UConn came in. Now, in addition to the explosion of women's basketball, that media rights deal is anticipated to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 million annually. So UConn itself was worth approximately $10 million additional annually to the conference, and even those numbers obviously dwarfed by what football conferences, Big Ten, SEC do. So keep that in mind. Quickly here, Ryan in Indiana asks, GP and Norlander should do a head-to-head Jeopardy style trivia time contest over the summer. Nada can ask the questions in different categories from the previous season, and we can listen to GPL buzz horns down every time he wants to answer a question. Would be incredible content and a fun way to fill the off-season content schedule. What say you? GP, would you do a Jeopardy-style trivia time episode?
No. I don't have any interest in that. That doesn't sound fun to me.
What if we did it on a curve? So my questions were like a 4 or 5 on a level of difficulty and yours were a 1 or 2.
I'm still not interested. Okay. Yeah, how about this? If you want to watch Jeopardy? Watch Jeopardy.
We did this for social. We had a good time at the Final Four. They came to us. Ruben, who does a great job with our social across all sports, said, I got some great stuff for you. It's going to pop. It's going to be great. It's trivia stuff. And I said, well, I'm up for it, but this guy next to me might not be. So instead, Parrish just asked me the questions and I knew some of them and I was stupid on others. And yeah, it was fine. It was a good time.
Here's the thing, in all seriousness, like I appreciate the idea. And if we did do it, we'd have fun with it. I do find myself often, whether it's parties or dinners or podcast episodes, once I'm doing it, I'm having a good time. I just never want to do any. I don't ever want. There's a long list of things where I'm like, I don't want to do that. And then I do it and it's fine. But I always start from, I don't think I want to do that.
Maybe. See, you got it.
Here's the point I was trying to make. So if I did it, we'd have fun with it. Here's the problem. I'm just being honest here. I don't retain information that well. I don't just like.
That's
true. I don't like. Well, you remember the starting lineup for.
Who played in the Final Four in 2023?
I mean, this is hilarious.
Last year, okay. We were there.
I was there. UConn.
UConn won the title in 23. That's correct.
My Boilermakers.
No, that's 24. I know you know this year. Oh. I'm talking last year.
Okay, UConn. I think Miami was there. San Diego State and Florida Atlantic.
Look at you. See?
My God, good. Put me on trivia time. I'm like Ken Jennings. I'm like the Ken Jennings of this stuff.
Can you go 2022 real quick?
Come on.
2022 is easy.
2022 is easy.
It's easy. 2022 is like, I think 2022 will go down as one of the
Kansas, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Keep going. I don't remember. Come on. It's the Blue Blood Final Four.
Oh, Duke.
It's Mike Krzyzewski's last game.
Duke and Villanova.
There you go.
Yeah. I know that, but
how do you not want an episode of this? This is exactly what everyone wants.
All right. Come on. Let's do it right now.
Yeah. Let's go. Let's go, baby. All right. Hey, look at us, by the way. This was like an opening segment, 12, 13 questions, and we're going to get out of here with plenty of time for you to get to the studio. You've got the last one, non-hoops one, music one. I knew we had to do this.
Sean Wells, he's from Newport News, Virginia. He wants to know, what are your top songs named after a location?
So I took this to mean I spent an hour on this question last night.
I spent more time on this than I should have, but I did have a song, and I don't even know that it's my favorite song, but there was one song that just immediately popped into my head.
Okay. What'd you go with?
Holiday in Spain by Counting Crows.
Oh, that's a good one. How did I miss that? Although I have a different one. So here's what I did. If it was like location, it was too broad. So I narrowed it to either cities, states, or foreign territories. I got like 15 songs for you. I'll rattle off. Holiday in Spain is a great call.
A great song.
It's a great call. Great song. That's off of the album Hard Candy. 2002, Counting Crows, by the way. Give it a listen.
Some other ones, like this is just one I grew up with. Memphis, Tennessee, Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
Great song. These are just ones that popped into my head.
Are they songs that you, the ammo was songs that you like? Are these songs that you like?
Yeah, okay. I love that. Yeah, Chuck Berry. It's Chuck Berry.
Okay.
Chuck Berry, except for, you know.
I know. Keep it going.
Except for the people Chuck Berry did bad things to.
Yep, keep it going. Like
Empire State of Mind.
You know what? That one doesn't do much for me, honestly.
Hold on.
It's a big song, but just like Sweet Home Alabama is a big song, it doesn't do anything for me, so it's not on my list.
Okay. But it's a big anthem. Empire, I don't know. I appreciate Alicia Keys and what she did with that record.
Okay.
This isn't like my favorite. I haven't even heard the song in years, but it did pop into my head. The Taylor Swift Cornelia Street song. It's a song about a street in New York City.
That is Mark Pope's favorite Taylor Swift song, by the way.
It's a great song. Okay. It's a great song. Yeah. So, those are a handful.
All right. I tried to rattle off. I thought about it for about 30 and I came up with some songs and then I started looking around the old library and what else do I got? All right. Am I keeping this to three songs? No chance. And I'm already angry at like the 5 to 10 songs that I've forgotten that'll miss. Find us, tweet at us, email the show, shouts@cbs.gmail.com if you've got a song that's named after a city, state, whatever. States, California dominates this forever. Here are five. California Dreamin', Mamas and Papas, classic, epic. California Love, Tupac, obviously. Going to California, Led Zeppelin. California by Phantom Planet, OC theme song there. And then California Nights by Best Coast is just vibes all around. If you're unfamiliar with it, find it right now.
California Love.
Yeah, what did I say? I said California Love, Tupac. I said that. I added that. Okay. Five California songs. You can go forever on LA and California songs, but those are five of the...
Do you know what city is mentioned in more songs than any other song in the history of recorded music?
Ooh, that's a good trivia time there. What city is mentioned in more songs... First of all, before I give my guess, what was the source of you finding this information? Is it a reliable source?
Wikipedia.
Okay.
Everything I know comes from Wikipedia.
Okay. Give me three guesses. My first guess will be New York.
Not true.
Second guess is LA.
Not true.
Wow. Is it in the song title or in the lyrical content of the song itself?
The word, the city, is mentioned in the song. This word has been mentioned in more songs than any other city in the history of recorded music, according to Wikipedia.
This is a great trivia question. No New York, no LA. Would a foreign city overtake this? I don't think so. So I will go what was traditionally, but is no longer, the third biggest city in the country. I'll go Chicago.
The correct answer is Memphis, Tennessee.
No way. Memphis has been mentioned in more songs ever than any... And more,
it's the home of the blues and the birthplace of rock and roll, Norlander.
Listen, very worthy, but that is that's a heck of a nugget. I think I believe it, but it's true. Okay. Other songs from states. Nebraska by Mo, of course. Super Thick Chunks of Broken Life and Reality. Georgia, Ray Charles. Genuinely amazing song, obviously. Ohio, Neil Young. Virginia in the Rain, DMB. I had to get a DMB mention in there. One of the best studio tracks from that band in the past two decades. Mississippi Queen by Mountain. When's the last time you listened to Mississippi Queen? Because that song is a rocker.
Mississippi Queen is a rocker.
That is a rocker. One of the best cowbell songs ever, by the way. And then Texas Flood by Stevie Ray Vaughan. Those are states. Couple city ones for you. The Only Living Boy in New York, Simon and Garfunkel, is a stone cold classic, man. Sleeper pick is Atlanta by Stone Temple Pilots off their album number 4. Found this one last night. Hadn't listened to it in a long time. Panic in Detroit by David Bowie. Omaha, Counting Crows was my Counting Crows one, but Holiday in Spain I might like more than Omaha. So that's a great pull by you. Straight Out of Compton, NWA is obviously a pick. San Francisco by Alkaline Trio. Where's my Alkaline Trio fans at? That's right. And then if you want to get into your 2000 emo feels, Boston by the band Augustana. And then a few foreign lands ones for you. By the way, the emailer said he liked Amsterdam by Guster. I appreciate that. In addition to Santa Monica by Everclear. Guster, Amsterdam, and Coldplay has a song called Amsterdam. Closes their second album. Really, really good one. My five-year-old loves Africa by Toto. And it's like a genuinely great song, but because he loves it so much, I found myself loving it more and more in the past couple of years. B.O.B., Bombs Over Baghdad, Outkast, one of the best ones on this list. London Calling by The Clash, Radio Free Europe by R.E.M. And the last one is a deep cut that I insist you go find immediately, Vancouver by Jeff Buckley. So those are just some of my favorite songs named after cities, places, or states.
Kevin asked about Walking in Memphis. Just know that nobody in Memphis likes the song Walking in Memphis. We all hate that song.
Mark Cohn, by the way, C-O-H-N, I believe is Mark Cohn.
Yeah, I mean
walking with my feet 10 feet off a Beale.
Yeah, it's just he also says he walked from Union Avenue to the gates of Graceland. Buddy, I'm just telling you, there is no way you're making that walk. All right, you will not arrive safely.
Okay.
All right. I would pay a lot of money to watch Mark Cohn try to walk from Union Avenue to the gates of Graceland. He has no shot.
Okay. I'm not big on Walking to Memphis, by the way. Like, I get it. Like, I understand why it's a catchy song, but I tried to list you ones that I actually liked. Any and all music questions at all times. I appreciate that. Appreciate the mailbag episode. Appreciate GP's Wi-Fi returning to reliability. It got rocky there in the middle, by the way.
I know. I apologize. What really bothers me? I just thought of this 5 minutes ago. I have a hardwire Ethernet cord right down there. I could have just plugged in at any point and it never occurred to me. This is why I'm terrible.
You did it to yourself, and that's what really hurts. That's a Radiohead reference. One more, and then we'll get out of here. This is basketball related. I saw it in the chat earlier. No. This is news related basketball. And I assume you have an answer because it happened since we last talked. Look at Parrish. Well, two. One said, what's that? Your shirt. Another music. That's Nine Inch Nails, right? Yep. Nine Inch Nails. I'm rocking the Who. He's rocking Nine Inch Nails. It's a great shirt, by the way. Someone asked, Kadari Richmond is now at St. John's. You don't have St. John's in your top 25-1. That was a
literally 27. Well, I just need,
but
I
not
need...
in your top 25-1.
Right.
The answer is the question was why?
Because I got 26 schools ahead of them. Yeah, that simple as that. If Michigan State loses another player, it's over. It's over for the Spartans, and St. John's is sliding. Really, like they're like, I have a list. I can show it to you. They are the first of the others.
All right. There you go. That's a mailbag episode for you.
Woohoo! Woohoo! Is it time to go?
It's time to go.
All right. Shouts to Devin Downey. Shouts to Chester, South Carolina. Terry Teagle, he's a legend. Huck Larnell, thank you guys once again for watching, listening to, bearing with us. I sincerely apologize. I'll have this Wi-Fi situation straightened out. I'll have C Spire back over here today. This is outrageous behavior. I can't go through a whole weekend like this. If you're not subscribed, please go subscribe anywhere you subscribe to podcasts, Apple, Spotify, more of us than there are of them. That needs to be reflected. We'll talk to you again real soon. Bye-bye.
The baseball season is in full swing, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Stample, every weekday as we recap every player from every game. We'll talk waiver wire ads, drops, players to trade for, prospects who could make an impact, and everything in between. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.